I often use the analogy of a root, a tree with its roots. And the roots no one can see, and the tree they can see. But the roots is where the nutrients come from. And in the roots, you're exploring. So trees are like what people see. It's an organization, that's your organogram. But like underneath, you need like deep roots. If you want to grow a big tree, you need deep roots. And in the roots, you can only be guided by feeling. Mm. I do things based on what I feel, not on what I think. Mm. And like, I don't really have another setting.
Justin Letchert is the owner of Africa's most global and well-known skincare brand. Since 2000, he has navigated Bio Oil from selling a handful of products a year in South Africa to a product a second in over 160 countries. He believes that being born and raised on the African continent gives you innate creativity and tenacity, exactly what is needed to navigate the international waters of taking a brand global.
Welcome to the African Imaginary, Justin Letchert.
Thank you very much, Kangi Khoza.
Let's begin. So we're going to start with the game, Keep or Toss. Ready?
Very much so.
Okay. So choose a card and I'll...
Let's go with a circle.
Okay.
This one.
This one. Adventurer.
Adventurer.
Keep or toss.
Definitely keep. I think that everything I do, I judge it whether it'll be an adventure or not. So whether it's like work, you know, is it an adventure to do what I'm doing? Otherwise, I wouldn't do it. Or in my personal life, where I go on holiday, et cetera, et cetera. So it's actually a very good card to describe me. I mean, not like an adventure, like I'm, you know, like Indiana Jones.
Okay.
But I think it's apt.
Okay, well, we'll see. Next card. Which one should I pick?
Let's go with the triangle.
Ha.
Writer.
Keep or toss.
No, I'm not a writer. I can write, but am I a writer when I've got a wife that's a writer and therefore I'm not a writer? I'll have to toss it.
Only room for one writer in the family, clearly. Okay. Next card. Shall we pick this one?
Yeah, you do it.
Ooh.
Collaborator.
Yeah.
Should I lie?
Keep or toss.
Toss.
Always. Toss.
Yeah.
Okay.
I can collaborate, but, you know, like as an overriding, defining characteristic.
So I've chosen one for you.
Okay.
Listener.
Oi.
Keep or toss?
Toss.
Toss. Okay.
Does sound terrible now?
No, no, not at all. There's still lots to go through. You choose one.
I think I will. I'll go with the nearest one. Maybe I'll have more luck.
Okay. Ooh.
Sex, definitely.
Keep my toss.
Keep.
Okay.
Whether it's true or not, it's irrelevant.
I won't ask questions. I'm going to pick another one for you.
Dreamer. Yes, I'm a dreamer. Not dreamy, but a dreamer. I spend a lot of time in my head thinking, sometimes dreaming.
A dreamer
thinking leads to dreaming.
That's a sex symbol. I like where this is going.
Okay, we're doing better now.
Okay.
Geek. No.
Keep or toss.
No.
Definitely not.
I can't even use a computer.
Oh.
Baller. Definitely not.
Come on, Justin.
No, I'm not a baller.
Not a baller.
Kids would love me to be a baller.
Man,
but I'm
that
not a baller.
Been so fun. Hey. Are we going to have an interview or are we going to have like a
One more. Let's try to find like one that like at least is like makes me look intellectual or something.
I feel like our toss crowd is pretty cool.
Dancer.
Keep, Justin.
With my knees now, I'm not sure, but...
Come on.
I'll take it.
Well, you take it. Okay.
I like a bit of dancing.
Okay, so we've got adventurer, dancer, sex symbol, dreamer.
Oh, it's all sounding very porno.
Are you comfortable with that? It's quite revealing.
Yeah.
Do you want to do...
As I said, I was hoping with something like that would make me seem a bit more intellectual, but it just didn't come up.
So, if I can, I'd love to take you... back to the very beginning, more along the lines of where you come from. So when you think of where you come from, KwaZulu-Natal,
yes.
The ocean, the humidity, what kind of thinking did that environment produce in you?
I think that environment unwinds your fibers. And so people are very relaxed. and don't take themselves so seriously when they come from that kind of environment, and then until they have to. So they've always got this arsenal that they, or not an arsenal, they've got this place that they can return to, which is calm, because that's how they grew up, outdoors, you know, not wearing a shirt, running around, going to the beach. It's nature, basically, I would say. You know, it's kind of nature. So you've got a place you can return to. And it seems to be a good place to foster, what has. Durban's been a place that's fostered a lot of creators and creativity. So it's got to be just with something in the air, right?
Absolutely.
So I feel like it's a good place to grow up. A lot of people leave there, you know, and they get older and seek out more intellectual places or more stimulating places. Like, but I think growing up there is a gift.
Okay. And is there something about you and the coast?
Well, I have to be in water every day, so whether it's the sea or the pool. So I think, yes, the coast and humidity. I don't have much body fat, although I'm improving lately. Then, you know, I need to be warm, you know, one of those people that need to be warm. So, yeah, it's kind of like, it's in my DNA.
Yeah, type of thing. Except you've swapped the Indian Ocean for the Atlantic Ocean.
I know, it's the only downside.
We'll unpack that. So Durban is not often described as a global city, yet you built a global brand from that vantage point. What perspective did that give you that a place like London or New York couldn't have?
Yeah, I think that I don't think it's so much Durban as it is because, you know, I was living in Cape Town by then, but it's more about growing up in South Africa or Africa for that matter that is very beneficial. You wouldn't think so, like when you're taking a business globally. You'd think that if you're from sort of the global north that you've got, it's better, but it's not actually better because it's a long story. I can get into it, but it's like people from Africa or less developed countries have internal strength. And they haven't got institutions or countries that make them feel powerful, right? So you kind of realize that it's like everything in life. You don't realize anything until you go out there and then reflect back on yourself. But having gone right around the world and seen things and reflected back on it, it's like, you know, you get, I can tell you a story that encapsulates it. And I used to do it when I did my, I was a guest lecturer at the MBA school in Cape Town.
Okay.
And I used to end the talk with this story, and it's a true story. And when we launched BioOil in Japan, at the same time with the same distributor in Japan was an American company and a British company. And all three of us were dealing with the same distributor at the same time, launching our brands through them.
Okay.
But the Japanese being the Japanese, they are obsessed with quality. Right. But quality, it's not just an obsession with quality. It's like it's almost like it falls under under respect more than quality. It's, you know, if you get into Japanese culture. But let's just say they're obsessed with quality.
Yeah.
So everything you do, you send stock over, then they'll look at it under like a microscope, basically, and look at the writing on the bottles and see if any like of the artwork has got a little fleck on it from the printer, and they'll reject it and reject it and reject it because they're showing respect for the customer that will eventually receive it. But those kind of like levels of quality don't exist anywhere else other than Japan.
Yeah.
And so what they do is they keep doing this and they keep doing this, and it gets very frustrating. And they keep telling you, and when you fix a problem, they find another problem. You fix a problem, they find another problem. They have a department that's just there to find problems, which we would call problems, sorry, but that's not what they're calling it. And so during this process, the American, we were all getting frustrated, but the Americans and the British were getting more frustrated than us. And the only way I can describe this is both the Americans and the British eventually pulled out, because the Americans turned around to the Japanese and kind of said, listen, who's the superpower here?
Okay.
Right? And the British turned around and said, listen, who's got the queen?
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Why are you messing us around like this? And as a South African, you would turn around and say, like, what do we got? Like, what am I going to say? Like, you know.
Exactly.
So you've got, you don't realize how much internal strength you've got coming from Africa, because you've never been made to believe you're powerful because of anything else other than yourself. But you don't realize that it's just for us is normal. Mm. So people, they have externalized into institutions. The same reason like where you burn your hand on a McDonald's coffee cup, McDonald's is responsible, not you, right? Mm. It's the same principle. Mm. So that strength of like trying to understand the Japanese and seeing them as another culture, you know, if you come from a powerful country, you expect everyone to fit in with what you do. When you come from a less powerful country, you're happier to understand that country and to have more humanity about it. Why are the Japanese keeping on doing that? What is it about the Japanese? Yeah, you don't cut off very early. You just keep going.
Yeah.
That was like 20 years ago this happened. And 20 years later, we're still there and they're not there. And we're still encountering the same problems and we're still dealing with it. But culturally, we more adept at dealing with that. So the greatest strength you have in taking a brand global, I used to tell the MBA class, is that is coming from South Africa.
Incredible.
Yeah.
There's a humility with which we approach things when you come from this side of the world.
Correct.
And I guess that's what makes us humble visitors often.
Right? Correct. Correct.
Speaking of a global brand, so you sell a bottle every few seconds across 165 countries. What do you think is the magical power of bio-oil that has locked people into this brand?
The magic is that it's an oil, basically. That's like if you want to just have like the one statement. Hmm. But in terms of having it, the two elements to this question, if I can say, the one is, do you want me to talk about oil and why people love oil? Or do you want to talk about why it's in 165 countries? Because it's not in 165 countries because it's got legs and walked there. You know, it's 165 countries because of a whole lot of little things that happened to take it there. Mm. But our first encounter with it was, so Bao was developed in 1987, all right? My brother and I bought the business in the year 2000. So it was developed 13 years before we came along.
Okay.
It wasn't oil. It was sitting on the shelves of South African pharmacies alone, not in grocery stores, not in anywhere, just in South African pharmacies. And it was part of a portfolio of products owned by the company. And it was the only oil, and all the rest were creams and lotions, et cetera, et cetera. When we bought the business, we focused on the oil. And the owner said to my brother, when he handed over the business, he said about bio-oil, he said, this is the key product in the portfolio. He said, have you ever seen cream come out of a person's skin? Right? Mm. I mean, he was referring to that the skin naturally produces oil, which is called lipids. And this is why this product is so successful, right? Not, it wasn't so successful. It was the most successful in his little range.
Mm, okay.
And we focused on that product because, and then we started taking it around the world. And only then, okay, you got to understand that we came in sideways into the industry because my brother and I are both chartered accountants and we bought and we ran a mergers and acquisitions business in the pharmaceutical industry.
Okay.
And this was a business we were selling, right? So the bio business is a business we were trying to find a buyer for.
Okay, right? Okay.
And it's a long story what happened there, but the seller kept not wanting to sell it unless we sold it lock, stock and barrel. And there was a whole lot of issues. And to cut the long story short, we got so frustrated, we landed up buying the business ourselves, knowing absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. So our education in skin and how to take a brand global started from knowing absolutely nothing, right? And so it's we started to learn, right? And how we went about that is that just after, so we're in South Africa first, then we launched in the UK, and it went to number one in the UK in 3 years in body care. Okay. And
that's quite quick.
Yeah, very quick. And we started to think, we need to know more. You know, we came in as, we had the product. Mm-hmm. We didn't come in as scientists. We just came in and started running this business. And so we thought, we need to know more about the science. Mm-hmm. So what we did is we got together the top professors in cosmetic science around the world. There were four of them, all from different countries. And we got them into a hotel in Amsterdam. And It was quite ridiculous because we're like two, I mean, I was, you know, a lot younger then, and my brother's 4 years younger than me, and these guys are all elderly professors. And we're going, okay, so we've got this product bio-oil, and it's number one in the UK, and we've done clinical trials, and it works. so why does it work? Mm. You know, it's like, seems like a ridiculous thing to be asking someone if you own a product that's number one. Mm. So how does it work? But we had bought this thing, you know, so, and then we're going, look, what are you talking about? So we say, well, there's something about oil, right? And then I would keep asking the question and they would go off on science speak, like get very complicated very quickly, as four professors in a room can do, right? Mm. And I kept listening and like, I couldn't follow, and it just sounded like nonsense. So I kept saying, no, sorry. Can we just come back to my fundamental question here? And I kept doing this and they were getting more and more frustrated. And eventually the one professor says, well, maybe it's because your marketing's good that it works. So I said, well, I think our marketing is good. Mm. Otherwise, you know, we wouldn't be able to have launched in the UK and told everyone about it. Mm. But marketing's only good for the first sale. Mm. The second sale happens if the person likes the product, and that is what's happening. Mm. So yes, it could be the marketing, but I don't think so, right? There's something about oil. And I kept going on and pushing this question in the face.
About oil.
And eventually, this Dutch guy, the Dutch professor, he just cracked. And I swear to God, he jumped out of his seat. It was like it's etched into my memory. And he jumped out of his seat like this and he said, it's as simple as this. The body is made up of water and it needs oil to keep it in.
Amazing.
And I was like, what? What did you just say? He says, the body is made up of water and it needs oil to keep it in.
Yeah.
The same as if you put water into, I mean, oil into a beaker of water, right? It floats to the top, right? You take that beaker and you put it in the sun, the water won't evaporate. Mm. Right? It will stay there. You take another beaker without the oil on top and the water will evaporate.
Mm.
That's how the skin works. The skin is constantly producing moisture from within, rises up through the skin and escapes. The body produces oil that sits on the surface of the skin that slows down how quickly it escapes. And that is how the skin works, right? The skin does that, if you want to get slightly more technical. The skin is constantly regenerating itself, right? In a month, it will completely regenerate itself in a healthy person, right? In order for the cells to regenerate, you need biochemical reactions, right? Mm-hmm. Millions every second, right? Mm. The lubricant for biochemical reactions are enzymes, right? And enzyme activity only happens in the presence of moisture.
Okay.
And that's the whole story of the skin. That's why this moisture comes from and goes up, gets stopped, holds in your skin, biochemical reactions, enzymes, biochemical reactions, skin regeneration. So the oil, because of the top layer of your skin is oil, when you put oil on your skin, right, you're supplementing this layer firstly, but oil accepts oil.
Okay.
Oil rejects water.
Okay.
Right, so when you put oil on your skin, it gets accepted into your skin. Mm. That's why they call skin lipophilic,
okay,
oil-loving, and hydrophobic, water hating.
And is this all skins, or does oil sort of naturally absorb into certain skins more than others?
All skins. All skins work the same way.
So why do black people love bio oil so much?
Because they're clever.
Yeah, I mean, when I think of oil, I mean, it's more than just aesthetics, right? It's also very healing. That's what it feels like. It's like a ritual to put oil on your skin and on your body.
Mm.
Unlike a fancy cream that you find in a pharmacy.
I think that some people on an unconscious level can feel that the skin wants oil and they use it because of that. But you also got to understand that black skin is beautiful, right? So when you put oil on it, makes it black, can really be beautiful.
Visible.
You can't put as much oil on my skin, it's not going to look much better. You put oil on your skin, it's going to look a lot better.
Yeah.
Equivalently, if your skin dries out, yours will look worse than mine.
Exactly.
You've got long, good upside and bad downside. So.
Exactly. If you want to insult a black person, tell them they look ashy, and trust me, you've got their attention. So.
Exactly. So, yeah. And I think that's why oil is so popular. It's like polish.
Yeah.
You know, it's like polishing.
But there's also a bit of a nostalgia when it comes to bio oil in particular, because I think nowadays there's many oil brands, right?
Yes.
But when you say bio oil, everybody knows what you're talking about. And that's not even a uniquely South African thing. I mean, I think it's all over the world. You just mentioned that in the UK, it was, you know, number one in the UK at some point. I think the Americans love it just as much as well. We've seen a lot of celebrities, you know, without even punting the brand, mention the fact that as part of, particularly through pregnancy, right?
Yes, of course.
As part of their routine, use bio oil. But what is the nostalgia around bio oil, do you think?
Okay, I think that, you know, we were the first to start bringing oil back. It's very important that I say back, right? Because you've got to understand that the skincare industry pre the Industrial Revolution was all oil, right?
Okay.
Okay, so the thing is that creams, lotions, body butters, these are all emulsions. Emulsions are made by mixing oil and water together with an emulsifier, stirring vigorously, and you get a white, fluffy substance, right?
Mm.
Nivea, the blue tin, those are the guys that started it, right? Over like 130, about 130
started
years.
Started the moisturizer.
That cold cream, what's called a cold cream, is like started when they started making emulsifiers for the skin.
Okay.
White, fluffy, da-da-da. This just... The skincare industry today, as you know it, this powerful, massive industry, is all because of that. It all became something because now you could make it, a lot of it, you can make it en masse, and it's like, and you could put preservatives in, and you could preserve it and can last longer. And it was cheaper because it's mainly water. Right? So those things are mainly water. So suddenly oil, which was expensive, and remember, the oils were used by royalty and the wealthy in the old days for skincare long ago because it was so expensive. Mm. But now it became available to the masses, right? And it just exploded. The industry exploded.
Yeah.
And no one for one sort of second stopped to think, okay, we're putting a lot of water in there to make it, it makes it fluffy and it makes it very skin friendly. Let's be honest. The cream is very skin friendly. And it's, I'm not dissing creams. I'm just saying it's like, but no one stopped to think we're actually selling water, which is skin reject. Okay. But it makes this great product and it's white and fluffy and it's a good price. So
do you think oil got left behind in this whole, skin debate? This whole, evolved over the last couple of years.
It got left behind.
Amazing.
And that is why Dieter Bayer, who was the guy that owned the business before us, developed this product for himself to use for his dry skin in Johannesburg.
Okay.
Yeah. He was actually a German guy living in, from German family living in South Africa. And he developed it. And he was the one that started, well, and then we picked up on it, right? And we were like, because we knew nothing, it was a massive advantage.
Mm.
Because if we had come from the industry, we would have been schooled in emulsions. Anyone doing cosmetic science is schooled in emulsions.
Okay.
Right? How to preserve them, how to keep them stable, etc. All active ingredients. Okay, so, okay, well, technical now. Okay, well, that's stuff that makes anti-aging, right?
It's amazing that a man can talk about skincare the way he can.
But I mean, it's like those ingredients, those active ingredients that for aging and stuff, they are water-based active ingredients. You've got to dissolve them in water. So the whole active ingredient industry that grew for the last 100 years made active ingredients that would go into water, not into oil.
Okay.
Because you were always putting it into emulsion where the water phase is the larger phase.
Okay.
Right? More water. It's like 80%. Your cream is like 80, 70% water.
Yeah.
Right? God, I'm getting lost now in this conversation. But what were we saying? Oh, so why do people like it? Okay. Mm. I think it's because, one, we were one of the first to start bringing it back. Two, it was a single product that was promoted through word of mouth and testimonials, right? It was what other people were saying, not what we were saying about it. So we wanted to have this under-promise and over-deliver. That was the cornerstone of our approach.
Mm.
And it made it this like humble one-product brand.
Mm.
All right. Only from 1987 to 2018, it was a one product brand. It's now we've launched three new products. We've got, which are all got oil in them. Because in 2010, we only developed a laboratory, that focuses on the, on research into oil in skincare.
Okay.
And then the first product came out in 2018. So for 1987 to, for a long time, let's just say, I can't do the math. It's just a single product. So it's a stable in your cabinet. It's like a friend,
Absolutely,
you know?
Absolutely.
It's like a friend, that product for people.
You take it everywhere with you. It's, you know, you mix it with your moisturizer if it's not oily enough. But you're right. It's always with you.
Yeah.
And where is skincare today? Just out of interest, do you think there's a greater appreciation for oils? Because everybody in my world, uses a lot of oil for skincare. I think it's a big base of one's skincare routine. I mean, and for us black people, our hair as well. So it's a big part of our lives.
Yeah. No, it's grown exponentially off a small base, but as a portion of the whole skincare industry, it's still small.
Yeah.
So you know what it's like. You know, it can grow. It's doubled, tripled, it's tenfold, let's say. But it's still not even, I don't know what the percentage would be, 3% of the whole market. You know what I mean?
Okay.
But it continues to grow, and people are more. And there's a lot of thing about oil. People have got like, oil is greasy, oil causes acne, oil's this, oil that. It's like you're growing up being told those sort of things. Mm. So it's hard to dispel that type of thing.
Yeah, it stays on your clothes. It's,
and a lot of it is true, but a lot of it has changed. Mm. So you can make a super light oil today. Mm. You can make a non-greasy oil today. It's not true about acne. It's like, and so,
that's,
you know,
true.
It takes a long time to change people's minds.
Yeah.
And that's the process we're going through. I don't think we'll finish in my generation.
And speaking about that, do you feel that people are far more educated nowadays around, you know, what their skin needs, for example? I mean, also with social media and all the information that's on there, it looks like people have also become their own skincare experts.
Yeah, I would say generally they're more informed. There's no question about it. But there's so much disinformation that, and so much, and not intentionally, people just say what they want to say and then it takes off and then people believe it. And I don't think it's like, but I mean, it's so complicated, cosmetic science. It really, really, really is a difficult area to understand. And the people that talk about it, have you ever seen a cosmetic scientist on Instagram?
No.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You know, it's like the people that are talking about it are people, are self-appointed experts, basically.
Yeah, beauty experts, beauty influencers.
Yeah, but they're all self-appointed, you know.
But does that make it easier to have a brand or harder? I mean, because, okay, back in the day, maybe there wasn't as much information. So I suppose when you're doing marketing, it's slightly, there's a lot more effort behind it. Whereas nowadays, the information is a little bit more democratized. However, it's not as peer reviewed, I would say, as it would have been previously. So what is it like having a skincare brand in an environment where information just gets put out, good, bad, that could hurt the brand, that could help the brand?
It's more difficult.
Okay.
And the fact that if you're taking things seriously, you get drowned out by people that aren't taking it seriously, which is the way of life.
Okay.
Because today you can, you've got influencers that launch skincare brands, right? 30 products in, they launch 30 products in a year. Right,
wow.
And they have a fully fledged brand.
And you had one for the longest time.
Yeah, we got four over 40 years. So, because it's so difficult to do something that's really a breakthrough, you know.
Mm.
So we only prepare to launch a product if it's a breakthrough. So we're not really interested in just line extending and having this brand that, you know, oh, they buy our brand, they'll buy something else from our brand mentality.
Yeah.
But that's not the case with influencers or actors or celebrities that, you know, oh, someone comes to them and says, you could have your own skincare brand. I'm a contract manufacturer. I'll give you 30 products tomorrow that you can, I've got the formulations, I can manufacture them. And then you got this brand promoted by someone. And it's a Me Too product. It's really almost 99% identical to something that you can find on the shelf.
Mm.
They're not really trying to break new ground at all.
Okay.
They don't even have their own laboratory, you know.
Okay.
It's like, so for the people that are doing it, taking it seriously and trying to break new ground, it's more difficult, but it just makes it, in a way, it makes us more keen to do it because someone has to be the counterbalance to that, and the world can't just go this direction, you know.
Absolutely.
And I think eventually people realize they come around eventually, you know.
Yeah,
you know, you can date for a long time, but then when you get married, you have to take it seriously, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, that's fascinating. I mean, just out of interest, are there a lot of copycat brands out there to buy all?
Yeah.
Lots of things that purport to do the same thing, but don't exactly deliver the same results.
No, and haven't done clinical trials, et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, you know, even the retailers, they bring out copycats. So like if you go in America, they're the quickest to do it. Like, you know, the big pharmacy chains like CVS or Walgreens or Walmart, as soon as a any product, not ours, any product reaches a certain turnover, they will bring out a copy of it.
Okay.
And then they even write on their packaging. This is where it gets really ridiculous. They'll write on their packaging, compared to bio-oil.
Oh, wow.
They'll even put our name on their packaging.
Wow.
Which is just ridiculous.
But I mean, I think bio-oil, when I think of it, is also such a disciplined brand. I've seen at Oratumbo, as you enter the airport, there's a big billboard, and it's just the bio-oil oil itself. And I think there's like a fine print writing in the background.
Just like wallpaper.
And it's amazing when you just see those orange letters that, you know instantly that that's a recognizable, you know, oil that you would use.
So. Yeah. No, we try to be consistent and not, it's a lot easier when you've got a founder or an owner that's been running the marketing for 25 years.
Yeah.
And other brands, you've got a marketing director for 5 years and then another one and another one and another one. So consistency is very difficult, you know.
Mm.
So for us, it's not so difficult.
Yeah.
But we know where we're going. And even it's like it's slow and steady for us because we're not in – we want to do things properly and we want to do things with soul and we want to do – yeah, we're not just interested in the turnover. We are genuinely interested in helping people to have better skin.
Yeah.
And it's a terrible thing to say, but 99% of the industry isn't.
Mm.
And they're interested in their turnover. And if you go to a meeting with and you sit with these people, you'll never hear them talk about the user.
Wow.
Never.
Wow.
Talk about everything other than the user.
Yeah.
Well, you talk about the user and about how to extract more money from the user, but not about, when I say the user's skin.
Yeah.
You never hear them talking about the user's skin.
Mm.
And their laboratories are disconnected from their marketing departments. So it's like, you know, it's just ridiculous. There was a stage about 10 years ago when all the multinationals wanted to buy us.
Okay.
And
Tell us about that. Why has no one ever bought you out of bio-oil?
Yeah. So the thing is, what happens is as soon as a brand breaks through onto the global stage, then the big multinationals, they want to buy it and add it to their portfolio because they don't really have the ability to start new brands.
Exactly.
Right? They've gone past that long ago.
Definitely.
They need entrepreneurs and creative people to do that, and then they want to buy them as soon as they break through.
Mm.
So, of course, as soon as something breaks through. So my brother and I ran a process with a merchant bank when we went to see all the big multinationals, and it was literally like the guy from the merchant bank said he's never seen anything like it in terms of the interest in it. So we went New York. I won't mention the names of the companies because they're all under confidentiality agreement. But, you know, New York, you know, France, England, and you can imagine the names, Germany. You can start putting brand names to that. And then in each one of them, the meeting with the CEO was just so, and I come from mergers and acquisitions, not an industry
exactly.
I don't know.
You're a finance guy as yourself. Yeah.
So, and like, you know, went to see the one company and the guy sits down and he starts saying, we've got 10 billion euro brands, 10 billion euro brands. Mm. In our portfolio, we've got 10 brands that do over €1 billion each. And he looks at me and I'm like, and I realized I was supposed to be more impressed than I was, right? But I didn't really know that he was looking for it. Like, then I suddenly realized he was waiting for me to go, oh, my God, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't go, oh, my God, because I just thought, like, why was he telling me this?
Like,
and he didn't really, like, and then he got rattled after that. Mm-hmm. And he didn't know how to connect with me as a human being, like, and
because after that hook, I mean, were you not?
He didn't want to, like, he knows his company wants to buy this and he will be, like, rewarded if we buy it. But he's got no idea of, like, who I am or how to talk to me as a human being. He's risen so high up in a company that his humanity has completely disappeared.
Okay.
And it's like, and it happened time and time again.
And why weren't you impressed by that?
I was rattled by it. I was, like, completely, like, oh my God, the world's gone mad. Like, are you human? Like, one of the CEOs, which was great, so I was looking forward to it, a woman, the first woman to run one of these massive companies. And, you know, she walked in and I just felt so sorry for her because she didn't know how to act like a woman. She was like, it was all this bravado and then...
This masculine energy. In
Then it was like, by the end of it, she was saying, like, things like, oh my God, I wish I had your job. I wish it was you guys.
Oh, wow.
And I was like, oh God, this is awkward. Mm-hmm. Like, and just this weird thing after weird thing, like going into a boardroom in Switzerland in a small town, smallish town, and got inside and there were no windows open, and I'm like, and there are no windows opening now and I'm sweating now, right? So I just can't do without oxygen.
Yeah.
So I walked in and I was like, there's no oxygen in this room and we're going to be here for 2 hours.
Yeah.
So I said, do you mind if I open a window? Mm. And this is like in like Heidi country, like, you know, it's like,
and this was
rolling hills, and no, it was like mid-season.
Okay.
It wasn't freezing outside.
Okay.
And they said, oh, and, you know, they're all like, also, when they want to buy something from you, they want to like really treat you well, right? Because they think that's going to work.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, he wants the window open. It was like, he wants the window open. He wants the window open.
The windows.
Like, how do we open a window? And it was like, they had to get like the janitor who came in with like a screwdriver or like an Allen key.
Because nobody opened
the window before. In Switzerland, with the cleanest air in the world.
I can understand
right?
that. Yeah.
And it's like, wow,
yeah.
The world's gone mad.
Yeah.
And it was like, we're going through this process. And then it was like one after the other, after the other. And it was like, eventually turned to my brother and I said, we just can't do this. We've just got to hold up the flag for humanity. Like,
okay.
We've got to just, you know, just keep going. And
so you did consider it at a point in time.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was just more like, yeah, we considered it to see what it would feel. I often do things to see what they'll feel like.
Mm.
And then it felt like really terrible.
It wouldn't be.
And I said, we just got to bail on this. It was super embarrassing. And then we pushed on to like, and then I knew what I wanted to do, that I wanted to do a brand that had humanity at its core and not profit and not turnover and not everything. And you can, that is the thing that you feel with BioOil.
Mm.
And if that's what we achieve over a period of time, it's like, that'll be a success for me. Not, yes, I want everyone to try it and if they like it to use it around the world, but I really want to not be driven by the things that these big corp. I think those people have been that work in those companies, they're not really that happy, they've just been sucked into it and they don't know any better. So someone's got to start a new vein, if I can say that.
But I love this conversation because I think, you know, it's very easy to talk about the success, but we never talk about the detours and the mistakes along the way.
Yes.
But it sounds like this is a good example of where, you know, you could have detoured and gone a different direction.
Yes.
But by exploring that path, you sort of revealed a deeper truth about
yes.
your sense of purpose and what you wanted
exactly
for the business.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Yes. So, like, I think that that exploring, and sometimes I often use the sort of like analogy of a root, a tree with its roots, and the roots no one can see, and the tree they can see, but the roots is where the nutrients come from, and in the roots you're exploring, and like you have, because it's dark underground and you can't see, and roots all cross over each other like this, whereas the tree, all the branches are looking for the sun, so they don't cross each other. So trees are like what people see is an organization that's your organogram, but like underneath you need like deep roots. If you want to grow a big tree, you need deep roots. You
yeah.
need people who can deal in the mess and stuff like that. And so those doing things to get a feeling are very important because you can, in the roots, you can only be guided by feeling, right?
Mm.
So some, you talk about mistakes, like what you want to be doing is like exploring all day long. Okay. That's my job, right? To be in the roots all day long, looking and looking and looking
Amazing.
For better things, right?
Mm.
But that's, everything is, oh God, there was no nutrients over there. And like you're blind and now you go there and oh my God, there's no, and bang your head against another root or what. That's what you're doing. You're just making mistakes, but it's based on feelings. Sometimes you expose that seeking to the world, like when you go out to feel this, and then, or you do something and you manifest something that you think is right, and you've worked long and long and hard in the roots, and then you bring it above ground, and then you realize it's wrong, and everyone sees it.
Yeah.
And then that's when people say, ah, you made a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah.
I made 100 mistakes before I made that mistake that you saw, but I just keep it hidden underneath, under the ground, you know? So it's like sometimes a mistake gets seen, but I don't really see anything as mistakes. It's just constantly seeking a greater truth, you know?
But how do you not get stuck in that whole, you know, enjoying the mistakes and constantly detouring? When does it become important to then have a sense of direction within all of that? Because it sounds like you have a great relationship with making mistakes, which a lot of people don't have.
Yes.
Could be mistakes, could be failure, however you define it. But at which point do you then go, well, it's also important to have something that gives you a sense of direction?
For me personally, I don't need that. But for the rest of the company, they desperately need that. The beauty of a success is that you've got time and money to go deeper into the roots. Mm. And so that's where, if you look at like an Apple, right? Steve Jobs is a roots guy, right? Like he pisses people off when he gets up into the tree, right?
Yeah.
And you know immediately he's a roots guy, right?
Fire and bring him back.
Yeah. So it's like you want to be successful enough to have this having in a direction and the roots that can continue to feed or alter that direction, but then people don't get exposed to it. Mm. It's a terrible thing, but when they do get exposed to it, and if they're not roots people, it's like I said, don't get in our business, be careful to get too close to Justin, you'll get burnt.
Yeah.
Because he's not coming up for air, you know. It's like it's roots people. They just keep going and going and going, you know. And it can get really frustrating for people that need the direction.
Tree. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So for me, it's not important, but for other people, it's very important.
So basically, what you're saying is you're someone who can stay down there,
yes,
the roots for a while.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I prefer it down there.
You prefer it down there. So what's your creative process, and what does it look like for you? How do you create? I mean, this podcast is called The African Imaginary, and we're interested in creators, right? And creators come in all shapes and sizes. Mm. Could be the arts, could be business.
Creation is not a linear thing, so it's like you draw, you know, that's the thing. Like you say, growing up in KwaZulu-Natal is like it's a major factor in like you trying to just pull something out of thin air. So you can't say like, oh, well, you know, yes, you can say if I meditate, if I swim every day, it definitely helps. What you want to try and do is connect with humanity as much as possible in trying to like observe humanity in all its forms. So for like a while, like I was not traveling so much. I used to travel a lot, and I got a lot of inspiration and creativity from traveling because I was exposed to so much of humanity and different cultures in humanity. And I was cut off from that, and I couldn't work out why I was struggling so much. And then I realized like I'd stopped traveling and stopped connecting. And so you have to be an observer of human behavior and your own behavior and how it's all connected. And then something just happens, right?
Mm.
I mean, that's what creativity is. It's not quite sure where it came from, because if you are sure where it came from, it's, then that's different. That's the tree. It's not the roots. You know, the roots is just not sure. It's dark and you can't see. It can only be a feeling. So you're looking for a feeling. You're hunting a feeling, and you got to feel everything. So when you go somewhere and you feel something, like you got to go like, oof, why am I feeling that? Or why am I feeling this? Or is this normal? Or why do I feel awkward when this woman walks in and is acting like a man, you know?
Mm.
I'm more uncomfortable than she is, you know?
Mm.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
So as an observer, what do you think most people misunderstand about human behavior?
Kangi! Good question.
I mean, it sounds like observing people and being an observer is a big part of your creative process, right? So what I'm trying to understand is how observing people then forms part of your intuition, because this is where your creativity is centered, right? So what do people misunderstand about human behavior?
I don't think that they even bother to understand it, that they actually are going to misunderstand it even.
Okay.
I think like essentially everyone is the same, right?
Mm.
So all those things about wanting to be loved or wanting community or wanting to feel safe or whatever, they exist in all human beings. But like if you go to a country and you sit down with the team in another country, they'll go, "Phew, it's so different here."
Yeah.
It's so different in our country. And you're going, really, why is that? And they can tell you, and there are differences, but they're not fundamental differences.
Exactly.
So people get confused, but like, what are fundamental things?
Yeah.
And in essence, we're all the same. And we get confused by the by the outer circle and of what like the differences are. And I don't know, for some reason people are more interested in those things than the real thing, like the big things that they really want. I think people gravitate to complexity. That's the thing with humanity. Okay. We gravitate to complexity rather than simplicity. And when you gravitate towards simplicity, it's easy to understand everything in a grain of sand. And if you gravitate to complexity, you keep yourself in like a confused, numb state, which feels like home, you know, but it's not really. You know, it's a complex, that's why I was joking when I said it's a shit question, because it's a bloody good question.
It is a very complex question.
It's a very good question that you need to ask like a philosopher, not me, you know, like.
Well,
we're going beyond my remit
you
now.
You put thinker back, okay.
Where's the sex symbol question?
Don't worry. We're getting closer to the dreamer stuff. Don't worry. But I mean, so because it's a big part of your creative process, let's ask it maybe slightly differently. What shuts down your creativity? What makes you feel not as creative as you'd like to be? I guess not traveling is one of them.
I'm quite affected by the environment and by people. So it's okay if I'm immersing myself and looking at it, but then I can't have like if I'm trying to brainstorm with something and then they'll say, oh, can this person come? And I said, definitely not. And they'll go like, why not? Can't they just listen? And,
really?
Chance. They're going to affect the energy in the room.
Oh, really? Okay.
You know, like, so there's a lot that affects, if you're feeling like you can't have someone, let's say maybe that's going to have an ego, let's say in the room. And then it's like, you're just trying to get into a space and then someone's going to ask an ego-driven question or make an ego-driven statement. And then you're dead in the water, you know? And I mean, ego-driven statements are what a board meeting's all about, right? So nothing's ever going to come out of a board meeting. So, yeah, you know, like...
Well, I mean, big decisions come out of board meetings, approvals, strategic direction.
Environment as well, like, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with you. I think energy is a big thing, right? In stifling people's creativity.
Yes.
And energy comes in the form of people. It comes in the form of environment. It comes in the form of what drives people as well. And I think it's very difficult to create an environment where the energy is off. And that's why culture is so important in an organization, for example. It's actually solving for that, at least in my opinion, you know, because I personally think you can find competence, but to find people who have a cultural fit to what you're trying to create and where you're headed.
Very important.
Oof, that is the stuff that I think MBA case studies are made of. And I don't think any one of them has properly solved that complex problem on how organizations protect that.
It's very important.
Especially where the future's involved.
Yeah, one person can throw it out.
Yes. So let's talk about brothers, business, and the collective. So you've built this business alongside your brother.
Yes.
And what kind of dynamic or tension makes this collaboration between the two of you work so well in the case of the business that you both run?
He's the nicest guy on planet Earth, and that's why it works.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I got lucky.
And where is he based?
Durban.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
He runs a laboratory.
Okay.
So he's now the cosmetic scientist. Okay. But yeah, like we get on really well. So we're friends as much as we are brothers. So we like very good friends. And I think if there were two hims, it could work. If there were two me's, it could never work.
Yeah.
But me and him works really well. And you know what happened when we first bought the business? We both knew nothing. We gravitated just organically into our positions, which was a beautiful thing. He gravitated firstly to manufacture.
Okay.
And again, he's an accountant. What's he doing in manufacture? And from there, he gravitated into being a self-taught cosmetic scientist and working with professors like on a peer level now. And so he just loved it. Turned out he loved it. He should have studied that, you know. God knows why. We both studied accounting, maybe because my father was an accountant. But the thing is that, and I gravitated towards marketing because I'm super interested in human behavior, which is the cornerstone of marketing.
And you're quite creative as well.
Yeah, and also like structuring, or what's the word, designing a global business to work in the simplest possible way is all about observing human behavior and then coming up with systems to make it work with humans. Mm. You know, it's the humans that are the issue, mm. right? And so you've got to design systems for humans. Mm. And so that was our greatest success. Like, for example... Okay, I'm going off piece. Do you want to ask about my brother? No, I'm not going to say that.
No. I'm quite fascinated.
It's too much business stuff. Let's talk about dancing.
But I do love the business stuff. So I interviewed your brother as well, by the way.
Oh, did you?
No, I didn't.
Okay.
But if your brother had to describe you in one word, what do you think he would say? Would he choose any one of the words that we have in front of us here?
No.
The phrase. Okay, so he wouldn't call you a sex symbol, that's for sure.
No. Sure. I mean, you know, it like comes a family joke when, you know, like people say, like, people don't like Justin, you know, like, you know, and they like him because he's so likable, and therefore I'm the one in the partnership. Like, I walk in a room, everyone gets scared, and he walks into a room and everyone is as calm as anything.
Oh, really?
I think daddy's arrived, you know? So
everything's going to be fine.
So I'm thought of in juxtaposition to him, you know.
Okay.
But you know. So yeah, it's you know. I don't. You know. Maybe describe me as difficult.
Oh really?
Okay. Yeah. Not difficult for the difficult sake, but I'm very like because I feel some. I do things based on what I feel, not on what I think. So it's like overwhelming. Like when I decide I want to do something, then it's like, it's not like there's another option. It's not like a spreadsheet with pros and cons. Like, so it's like, oh, well, then I'm just going to drive it through, like to completion. And so it's like, oh, you're being different. That's why you pulled out collaborate. It was like, oh shit.
I was hoping.
You know, like, it's like, that's not what I am, you know?
Yeah.
It's like everything is just based on following my feeling. And like, I don't really have another setting, you know? So it's like, I'm trying to develop one. Like now that I'm getting older, but it's like
a factory setting.
Yeah,
like an
my
iPhone.
Factory setting is just to follow my instinct, you know, and it's served me well up until now. So, and he knows that. He knows that. And he said, like, and he knows that it's worked. So he's good with it. But, you know, we'll joke about it, you know.
So you think he'd use the word difficult to describe you?
Yeah, probably.
And what word would you use to describe him? Well, you said nice. You said he's a nice person.
Easygoing.
Easygoing.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a good way to describe someone's brother. Sex symbol. That's a good one.
Apparently, if you speak to people in Durban.
Oh, really? Okay. Oh, I'll have to ask him. So talk to me about Africa. And what do you think the African continent's superpower is, and what does it mean in practical terms?
Yeah, it's closer to the roots. That's its superpower.
Yeah.
There's no trees. I mean, they're trees, physical trees. But there are no institutions, there are no big things, it's a roots continent. It's a roots continent, that thing that I was describing. So people that are, when you're close to the roots, it's like, remember I spoke about internal strength. So if you deal with people from Africa, they see you as a human first.
Yeah.
And then they see you from a business.
Yeah.
So if if you're in America, they go, which country are from, which company are you from, how much money do you have, and okay, you're a human.
Yeah.
And Africa, it's the other way around. So they see you as a human first, and then it's very easy for people in Africa to connect with each other because, you know, we're not really concerned so much about, like, all the other things. And so there's this massive, like, humanity and... Where does creativity come from? It comes from humanity.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So this
he
is
helps
like
us
this,
understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is like a creative hub, basically, the continent.
Amazing.
And it just hasn't been witnessed because people have to see the tree to know that you're creative, right?
That's true.
So you have to build the tree. So people say, oh, you know. Like I said with Bible, people say, "Wow, how many countries are you in?" You know, they don't ask like, you know, what do
the
you do, what's your feeling? You know, the root stuff. So you have to build something for people to recognize creativity.
Yeah.
So, but there's this like I'm not, it's just, there are people on this continent that, if given half a chance, would just be, would, they have to be, it's just not even a question, massively creative, just because of where they come from. Mm-hmm. And that creativity has been reducing in countries. That the more and more developed a country, the more difficult it is, because of your upbringing, because of your exposure, because of your everything, to feel enough to have, this creative energy.
To let it keep going.
Yeah. So Africa is this like incredible place. And then it's been, the narrative has been led by people that have got big trees, right? Like big news, CNN or BBC or blah, blah, blah. These are institutions. These are big companies. They lead them. The tree leads them. No, the roots doesn't talk. You can't see it. You can't hear it.
Yeah.
The trees talk. So countries with big trees, which are big institutions, they set the narrative. So they tell people what to think about Africa. But it's not really true what they're saying. And some of it is because you can't, they love stats. You know, if you're in the tree, you love stats.
Yeah.
Data is what you want to see in a boardroom. And when you're in the creative studio, no one wants to talk about data. They want to talk about human beings and human behavior. And that's the difference. So they're driving data and they can say, well, you know, the average person in Africa lives on less than $3 a day. You can go, okay, yeah, well, that is the data and I can't argue with the data.
True.
But how many of those people are smiling? Right. You look around and like people with very, very little are smiling. Everywhere you go in Africa, people are smiling. Unless it's like proper famine and war.
Yeah.
They are smiling their heads off, right?
Yeah.
And you go like, oh, is it the dark continent or the happy continent? Like, which one is it now? Like, but if you fed a narrative, like, it's like, but that narrative is now changing because of the thing you mentioned earlier about influencers and the democratization of the media. So now we're seeing a different story emerging quicker.
Yeah.
Because you'd have to build a massive tree to have a voice in the old days. You don't have to build a massive tree to have a voice today. So Africa's like on the rise. But what we must be careful of is that we don't start copying what happened elsewhere.
Absolutely.
And that we stay in the roots, because that's exactly what I'm trying to do with Biol. I'm trying to keep it there as to say, you don't have to look like that. What is the benefit of all of these things that you're doing and telling me you got 10 billion euro brands? What are you, and
what?
Yeah. And
yeah.
And are you happy? Like, you know, like, and so we mustn't race forward to try and like, it's like, it's all this thing about like competing and showing who's got the biggest tree. You know, it's problematic. You know, it's what leads to problems. And if we can sort of stay where we are and just enjoy our own happiness, I'm not talking about we must eliminate poverty and things like this, right? We have to be careful what poverty really is.
Okay, exactly.
Is subsistence living poverty? Because there's a whole lot of people due to AI that are going to have to go back to subsistence living now because there aren't going to be any jobs. And that's going to be super interesting because like, it's like, and you know what? They're going to be happier. I know that.
With AI or with subsistence living?
With subsistence living.
Well, I mean, yeah, look, I think as a continent, we should be more food secure than what we actually are. I mean, I was horrified to learn that even in South Africa, there are people who still die of kwashiorkor. You know, I thought that's something that only happens in war-ravaged countries. So there's clearly something amiss there. But I also get the sense that we're at an inflection point, no matter where you are on the African continent. I mean, if I look at my generation, where, you know, some of us have had the opportunity to go study overseas or even have a spell living overseas. I mean, you're also very well traveled. We are the generation and the people who could be living anywhere in the world but choose to live and work in Africa. So we're clearly onto something, right? There's clearly something we've seen and we've observed. And we're not romanticizing the challenges that Africa has, but I also think we all see the opportunity, number one. And secondly, the novelty. There's still a lot that's quite novel in this part of the world. And that brings with it an energy and a vibrance that I don't feel when I'm in the first world. Having said that, I do think, however, going back to the creativity you spoke about that we have in Africa, because I think we don't have a lack of creativity. I often wonder, though, how does that creativity translate into entrepreneurship, into creating businesses, into growing our economies, solving our problems.
It'll happen organically. It's like all the ingredients are there. Look how many entrepreneurs there are in Africa, far more than the rest of the world. Mm. I mean, they might just be a vendor, right? But taking your goods to market and selling it at a trestle table, that's entrepreneurship. That is a business, right? To have a bigger business, okay, now you need sort of some form of education in how a business works, et cetera. That's now coming up, that education to make these small businesses bigger. That will happen. You can't speed that up.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's going to take a bit more time. Mm. But there's creativity. There's huge amount of entrepreneurship. Mm. And to build these big things will just happen organically. I just got lucky that I was in the right place at the right time as a first generation South African with, my father was Dutch, with European something maybe in my blood, which is organizational skills, and got an education and was born in Africa. Mm-hmm. So I've got all the ingredients, lucky me, to build a big tree, but it's going to happen. It's going to happen for sure. And there's already loads of Africans in the diaspora that are like huge, because they're in that environment. So we just have to wait, and let's just enjoy our smiles while we're waiting, because they might disappear when we get there,
Well, hopefully not. But I mean, I've asked you all the serious stuff. I'm also fascinated to know, who are some of your favorite thinkers or artists or creators, or it could be business people, who have a love for Africa or are based in Africa that you hold in high regard?
Yeah, I mean, obviously one has to put number one as Nelson Mandela, because it's just, there's just like, there's not even a two and three after that, right? Mm. Because he is a person that just can teach you so much. This is a guy that embodies humanity and humility. So I would put him like a top of the list in terms of like inspiration, in terms of...
And in the next generation, do you see any signs of, thinkers or artists that you think really embody the spirit of believing in Africa's potential?
I mean, when I look at like... if I look at you and I look at Masaki, who you interviewed, and I'm like, wow, I'm just like, I wouldn't like to say there's like one person, like as I say, once you've mentioned Nelson Mandela, it's hard to say another name. Mm. I'm just talking in the South African context.
Yeah.
But if I look at those kind of people and how they are hugely successful, and still have so much humility and so much philosophy in their heads, it's mind-blowing, actually. Mm. And it's like, that's why I'm saying it's like, it's going to explode. There's a whole generation coming through now that, that has to leave the past behind and move on to the future. You know, being Jewish, we have seen that movie firsthand of, losing everyone in the Holocaust, and my father was in Holland during the war. And then you see how long it takes for people to recover from such a big loss, or the psychological impact that it has on people, on a culture or on a religion. And it doesn't happen overnight, but then eventually it washes out of the system.
Yeah.
And it's like you stop looking back so much, and you get this transition point when you look forward.
Yeah.
And when you look forward and you let go of all those things that you just cannot hang on to anymore, like because it's old and it's can't listen to it anymore now because there's too much water under the bridge. And, I don't go around saying, oh, you must do me a favor, I'm Jewish, we lost 6 million people in the Holocaust. Like, it would sound ridiculous me saying that. Mm. But like you mentioned the inflection point. We're at that inflection point now.
So too,
it's your age group that's at that inflection point. It's not people older than you. Mm. And it's kind of everyone younger than you. That's the exciting thing about the African imaginary and what you're doing here and why this podcast is so important, you know, because like we're not here to like complain. We're here to celebrate. Like,
yeah.
I'm just like, you know, thank the Lord I was born in Africa, baby. Like,
yeah, it's like, thank the Lord.
You know, and it's like...
thank the Lord bio oil is African, otherwise, who knows?
A lot of people
you would have sold to by now, but yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, it's the discipline of time, right? But the wonderful thing about time is also knowing when you're at a pivotal moment within that time. And I agree with you. I think my generation, we have a unique advantage because we have a deep appreciation for the generation that came before us. I really think it's a secret skill that we have. We're very aware of everyone that came before us, and we're also very aware of how different our lives are, but we're also very aware of how differently we want our lives to unfold. And you can only describe it as, you know, as you say, the hockey stick at that point
yes.
where things are shifting. But if you miss it, then it's gone.
Link. Yeah. You're the breakthrough generation.
And let's hope we don't.
Yeah.
So tell me, if your success was a roadmap, which roads would you intentionally leave unpaved?
Your questions are getting harder, not easier.
Yeah.
We've
spoken a lot about the road you've traveled. So I'm quite curious.
Would you leave unpaved?
Yeah, for the next generation, you know? Or would you put all the building blocks in place so that we follow and know which steps to...
No, because they're not roads. That's all routes.
Okay.
And roads are like, I don't see... That's why I can't... And I understand your question now.
Mm.
But I'm not putting any building blocks in place other than philosophy. And that's what I'm trying to prove is stop looking up at the tree and start looking down at the roots.
Mm.
Because the happiness comes from down there. That's where the nutrients are. And you keep, everyone's looking at, you know, the tree, is the tree going to grow? Well, you've got to look at the roots if the tree is going to grow. And that's all we're trying to do is turn the outside down to the roots and be cognizant of that.
Mm.
Because, like, that's what everyone struggles with, you know, how do I look? What brands am I wearing? What is this? What do I look like on social media? That's tree stuff, right? But, like, the roots, and then you get a lot of psychologists also on social media telling you, don't do that. Look over there. And then everyone's trying to, yeah. But I think, like, I'm just trying to do it in a business context.
Mm.
And it's weird to, like, how's that going to help? But business is, like, such a big thing, right?
Absolutely.
In the world. So
absolutely.
If I can do it in a business and we can do it in a business context, then that is going to be the most profound thing, you know? Then it'll be easier to see because it's visible. You know, me being, you know, trying to, like, sit all day meditating and being all zen and being connected to the roots and stuff, it's got nothing to do with nobody.
Mm.
But everyone's putting bile on their body, right?
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. Final question. Does your roots personally extend to East Africa in the future?
Mine does. My wife's doesn't.
Okay.
It's going to be like roots are going to split maybe. No.
Okay. What is your relationship?
She's coming around. But as you know, yes, I want to retire in Tanzania, yes.
What is it about East Africa that's got your spirits?
It's all to do with, like, it's got more of the feeling.
Mm.
It's the birthplace of mankind, you know, according to where the fossils have been found. Yeah, there's an energy over there. I like the fact that there's still tribes that live the way they've done for 1,000 years. I find that energetically very powerful.
Mm.
The Maasai being the one that I'm mainly that I'm fascinated by. You've still got Swahili culture, which is like a, I best not say how many years old, but 1,000 years old or whatever it is.
Mm.
It's like people living as they did. And that provides an intense energy to a country. And then, being naturally blessed with, you know, craters and Serengetis and Kilimanjaros and World Heritage Sites in Zanzibar. I mean, like, you know, like, if you can live there, why wouldn't you?
Yeah, I agree.
So, you know, that's the dreamer.
That's the dreamer.
Adventurer. And then I'm going to
dance
in East Africa.
I mean, I'm sure there's sex symbols in East Africa.
No, that's long gone. That's long gone.
Amazing. Justin Lichert, dreamer, adventurer, dancer, sex symbol. But in my opinion, a true son of the African soil who is very passionate about shifting global perspectives on what it means to build a business in Africa and what it means to be an African. Thank you for being on the African Imaginary Podcast.
Thank you, Kangi Khoza.
It's been an absolute pleasure.
It's been amazing for me.
Thank you.